the Cunningham.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Ecolab, dedicated to improving, cleaning, and sanitation standards for leading hospitality, healthcare, and food processing customers worldwide. On the web at ecolab.com.
It's 6 minutes now past 11. And good morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. 2001 Minnesota legislative session is finally over. Coming soon, the 2001 special legislative session. Minnesota legislature, as required by the state constitution, adjourned for the year late last night, but only managed to pass two of its major bills, the energy bill and the family and early childhood education bill. That's the one that provides money for programs such as child care assistance and Head Start. All the other bills, the tax bill, the education bill, the transportation bill, all of those other big bills failed to pass by the deadline last night, and they're going to have to be taken up in a special legislative session. Today on Midday, we're going to talk with the three key players in this drama. Over the noon hour, we'll be talking with legislative leaders Steve Swigum and Roger Moe. But to begin, we've been joined this first hour by Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura. And if you have a question or comment for the governor, give us a call here. Our Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free. That number is 1-800-242-2828. Governor, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Gary. Always a pleasure.
Any decision today on when you might call that special session?
No, not at all. It's far too soon for that. Before I'll even consider it, I want to, you know, the legislature to come out and say that their work's done and that they have an agreement, they've reached spending targets, that they've agreed on all the major bills so that when we do call them in, it will just be a one-day session. They can be in and out. So until I hear word on that, you know, we're fast approaching the shutdown of government on June 30th. Right. And I'd just like to say again, Gary, to me, 5 months wasn't enough. You know, when I had them in for one of the meetings, and I'd also like to clear up, I never said the quote, "I'll bury you." I don't know where that came from or how the media picked up or who said that, but I never said that to anybody. So again, they're running with a quote that is untrue. I'd like to know how they can manage to print a quote when they didn't hear it and then attribute it to me. I never did that. But getting back on task, you know, I when I brought the legislature together that final night, I said to them very specifically, I said, well, how will a special session change anything? It's still the same players at the table with the same problems. Why can't you solve them within 5 months? How will additional time remedy this? So, but again, they didn't heed the warning or for whatever reason, and now we're faced with either a government shutdown on July 1st or the night of June 30th at midnight, or faced with me calling a special session.
If you had your druthers, how soon would you like to call that special session, all things being equal?
Well, first of all, again, I'll reiterate, I don't think there was ever any need for it. 5 months was plenty of time. How much more time could it take? In fact, I'm now thinking that since they operate in this manner in the bicameral system, we should actually make the session shorter. Make them about a 60-day session, and that way then go into special session when the 60 days is up, because for 2 months nothing happened over there. And right now they didn't do barely anything. What got passed? They couldn't even reach spending targets. In 5 months, they couldn't even reach their targets of spending. And I know a lot of people say, well, that's that the governor should be engaged. We were engaged. I had over 55 meetings with legislators. My commissioners were always available, always engaged to try to help when we can. But that's why there's a separation of government. You have the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch. Everybody has to carry their end of the log, and I'm afraid the legislative branch dropped their end of the log.
Mm-hmm. There is a, I don't know what you'd call it, a rumor floating around that one of the preconditions that you might set for calling a special session would be a requirement that the legislature vote on the unicameral proposal again. Is that true?
That's not out of the question. I'm certainly thinking about it because, again, I'm not going to bash legislators individually or anything like that. That solves no problems. That doesn't do any of us any good. But I will bash the system in which they operate under, which is this bicameral system that with conference committees and the whole way it's set up, it just begs for these special sessions because there's no accountability in it. Everything can be delayed till the last minute like it was this time. Nothing gets done. And the focus isn't on the majority of main issues. For 3 months, you get all these other issues that aren't that don't affect Minnesotans in as a whole, in the large group, like the issues that they deal with early. And so I'm going to bash the bicameral system very heavily. I'm not going to bash legislators themselves at all. I think they're a victim of the system that they work under. And if we went to unicameral, many of these problems would be non-existent. And let's remember, when I brought up unicameral before, I got nothing but promises that they'd fix the bicameral, that it just needed a tweak here, a tweak there. Nothing happened. They didn't do a thing to fix this system, and now here we are, caught up in the system.
So you haven't made a decision yet as to whether that would be a precondition, but you're thinking about it. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking about it, yes, I certainly am. To put them on the record. I mean, if I think that they owe it to the people of Minnesota to take a floor vote on both houses saying, do you support putting unicameral on the ballot? Mm-hmm. And let them say yes or no so that, again, we won't fall victim to the product of the bicameral system. See, the bicameral system breeds plausible denial because it can be killed by one person in a head of a conference committee to where a vote is never taken, and therefore you can't hold anyone accountable. So I may say, yes, I'd like a vote on whether you would agree to put unicameral on the 2002 ballot and allow the people to choose what their government would be. And why would they be afraid of that? If the bicameral system is the better system, Gary, won't it prevail? Why would anyone fear that? Why would you fear having trust in the very people who elected you? I don't have fear of it. If bicameral wins, so be it. But I think that the opportunity should put out there and especially in light of what's happened here. And I'm a great deal believer in fate. I believe things happen for a reason, and I believe we're faced with the situation we have right now to give unicameral a spotlight and change the face of government in Minnesota.
You really think that would make a difference, though?
Oh, totally.
Pioneer Press reported today that if you look at Nebraska, which has a unicameral system, they've had as many special sessions as Minnesota has, and their legislature actually meets longer, which seems like they're getting less done in more time.
Well, maybe it's how you set it up, and it's what are they dealing with. Like, you can set it up to where you come into the legislature and you give them, say they start the 4th of January, you give them 30 days to set their spending targets. The federal government has that, right? Federal government, their legislature has to come in and set their targets immediately. We don't have that. Give them 30 days to set their spending targets, give them another 45 to finish the budget, then let them go to what I call these fluff bills. These bills dealing with, like, banning pop in school, which how much time did they spend on that? I heard there were 6 conference committees dealing with my outside work activities, which don't affect any Minnesotans at all. Doesn't affect anybody. I got my job done. We were there. My budget was in on time. And to my knowledge, I don't think they met on Saturday nights. In fact, they even took 5 days off over the Easter holiday period. I remember it because I was up sandbagging. And they were home for 5 days. Well, maybe they shouldn't have taken that mid-vacation when they had so much work in front of them to do.
Governor Jesse Ventura is our guest. By the way, on this unicameral issue, we're running a survey online on our website about whether your thoughts on the unicameral issue have changed as a result of what's happened this year with the legislative session. Log on and Have your say there. MinnesotaPublicRadio.org is our website address. Meanwhile, if you have a question here on our program for Governor Ventura, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Kim, you're first. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I have a comment on unicameralism, and I think that what this recent activities of the legislature point out is not necessarily the need for unicameral as much as it points out the need for a much smaller legislature. My concern about unicameral is that, as I understand it, in Nebraska, basically the lobbyists are in charge of the activities that happen there. And I think one of our big problems in Minnesota is that our legislature overall is just entirely too big for a state with our population, and there's too much room for legislatures essentially to hide in the weeds and work on these fluff bills, as the governor calls them, and work on these superfluous amendments and all this other essentially crap, basically, that doesn't do anything to get even the major issues accomplished and getting budget bills passed. So I think our legislature is just too large.
Well, I would agree with the caller. Right now we have a legislature of 201. Now, California, we have a population of around 4.5 million. California has a population of over 33 million, and I believe their legislature is down about 135. So we have, in essence, about 65 more legislators than California. But as far as special interest controlling unicameral, don't be naive, caller. Special interest controls the bicameral system here also. Without any doubt, it does. You've got without campaign finance reform and the way that contributions are made to the two political parties, and I can clearly state, you know, it was stated on another program, I overheard it, that special interest was controlling me on the conceal and carry, that the NRA was a big proponent. Well, because I agree with something doesn't mean special interest dictated it to me. I was a member of the Reform Party when I ran. We don't take money from special interest. It's against our rules. I didn't accept any money from special interest. So rest assured, special interest doesn't dictate to me. I mean, I may agree with something where there is special interest, because there's special interest on everything in the game, but it doesn't mean that it's affecting me. But I don't see where special interest would have any more control over unicameral than it does in bicameral. I mean, they're right now controlling the issues over there.
Matt, you're next. Go ahead, please.
Governor, I'm completely supportive of your positions that you've taken, and sometimes it takes kind of a rough guy to take all the hits at first, and hopefully there'll be somebody to follow up after you, whether it's independent, but it's just somebody with the character that you've portrayed. A question and a request. The question is, will the budget go back to what it was in the previous session, once nothing's decided on, for the previous biennium, won't it automatically go back to the previous spending levels? And secondly, rather than have the legislature work through this property tax reform, I think a lot of Minnesotans are feeling nickel and dimed to death on taxes that are taxing our necessities, like our primary residential telephone and heating costs. That's 7% on to the already high heat costs that we're going to experience in the upcoming years. And it would generally not allow anybody any luxuries if you're going to return that money, especially to the poor, to the wealthy as well. But it just gives people a general feeling like we're consumer friendly here now, and yeah, we will allow you to have your necessities, not necessarily a business phone, but a residential phone for the elderly, of course.
Yeah, well, first of all, if you looked at my original tax proposal, my budget, I cut income tax, I cut property tax, and I also cut the sales tax. The only thing we asked for was an expansion of the sales tax into the service industry, which failed because both houses wouldn't, and I believe that's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. It has to happen because of what our economy, the way our economy is going now, we are much more a service-driven economy than we are a goods-driven economy now. So in order for a sales tax to be viable, it's going to have to happen. They just simply delayed it. But in my original budget, I had tax reduction in all three. We could have seen tax relief in all three. Property tax, sales tax would have dropped the rate, and income tax drop. But as far as this idea that somehow cutting taxes for wealthier people is wrong, I think people need to remember who pays most of the taxes. You know, if you pay taxes, then you deserve a tax cut. It shouldn't be the redistribution of wealth. It shouldn't be government penalizing someone because they're successful. Well, you're successful, so we're going to penalize you, and we're going to give a break to the unsuccessful person. I think when it comes to taxes, taxes should be across the board to everyone. It should be fair and equitable. Everybody pays taxes. Wealthier people even pay at a higher rate. So, you know, tax cuts should be fair and across the board. And that's my philosophy, that everyone that pays into taxes, when there's tax relief, should likewise everyone should get relief, not just picking and choosing winners by the legislature or myself.
Senate Democrats are arguing that the property tax proposal that's being talked about, that you generally support, the House Republicans generally support, they argue that in the next couple of years, the net effect, if that program is adopted, is that property taxes will be shifted to low and moderate income homeowners. They say that's not fair.
Well, the one thing you have to remember on property taxes, that's a tax for services, Gary. How does a rich home get any more services than a poor home? Can you answer that for me? Property taxes pay for your police protection. They pay for your streets to be plowed. Hopefully we'll lift education off it, which I've finally gotten both houses to agree to do that we won't put that on the property tax anymore. But a property tax is a tax based upon services rendered to your home, basically. How is there any difference between a poorer home or a home, say, a value of $40,000 and a home worth $500,000? They both require the same services. Why should there be a big difference there? How can they say that somehow that'll shift all the payment onto the poorer properties? No, it won't. I don't buy into that.
Well, I guess the argument is that they need to collect X amount of dollars, and if they don't take it from higher valued homes, businesses, and the like, somebody else will have to pick up the load, and that would be the low and moderate income people.
Not necessarily. Why would you say that? Give me the reason why it would be low and moderate income people that would pick up that difference.
If you need it, I guess the argument is if you need to, again, collect X amount of money, somebody's got to kick that in.
So mine was an expansion of the sales tax to the service industry. Mm-hmm. And that would have more than made up. That would have made up for it. Plus a drop in income tax. You're not even getting an income tax cut now.
Do you think that's still a possibility that when all is said and done, the legislature might go for the expansion at least to some degree?
I don't believe they will this year. They don't have the courage to do it. You know, it takes some courage to reform. It takes a lot of courage to reform. You have to have courage to do it, and I don't think they have it. But I'm saying that eventually they will have to do it, whether not this year, 2 years from now, 6 years from now. Mark my words, eventually you will see the sales tax expanded to the service industry. It's just a matter of time. It has to happen. Economically, it's pushing us that way, the economy.
One other question on the property tax bill, since it's so important, apparently, to the big scheme of things here. Assuming that a bill passes that substantially reduces property taxes, what's in that bill, what should be in that bill to make sure that property taxes just don't go back up? Historically, time the property tax has been reduced, 2 years later, it's kind of back to where it was.
Yeah, and that's because we haven't did anything to control the local government. Just if you remember back to the days of the first rebate. Remember that first rebate, the one that never was, kind of, where they gave us all a $500 property tax rebate before I came to office? That was the one where I saw about $35, because what happened was they deducted my property taxes $500, but my local unit of government raised it up the difference, so it was just a shifting of money. Instead of going to the state, it went to your local unit of government. Well, what you have to do at that point is either put levy limits in place to where you don't allow them to go up. And my full tax package covered the whole thing. It took care of all of that, because it took the sales tax away from local units of government to where they wouldn't have to pay a sales tax anymore. And that's what would make up for them having to raise your property taxes then, because they would have gotten tax relief substantially right there. Remember when I came in here and said, look at my full proposal like a sweater? And if you start pulling pieces of yarn out of a sweater, first up one arm falls off, then the other arm falls off. Well, that's what they essentially did. They didn't look at the full picture. They looked at it, but then they started pulling the yarn out of it. And once you do that, then the proposal, then you end up with strictly just a property tax relief, and that's all. Where, you know, if initially in my budget, we could have gotten tax relief in all three.
Ron, your question, please.
Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Ron.
I personally wouldn't call them in back into session and then until June 30th. They'll give them one day and that to do something for a change instead of bleeding the taxpayers. And you're right, they should do it for free, like you said, and that for all the 5 months they sat over there and worried about pop in the classroom. That was the stupidest thing I ever heard of in my life. That's a parent's problem, not a school. I wish you would. I could find out how much that 800-pound gorilla gives to the Democrats and the Republicans that constantly saying that give them more money, give them more money.
Ron, you can find that out because that's all public information. You can call and find out what donations they make. But then the other part that the 800-pound gorilla, of course, he's talking about Education Minnesota, they also run their own ads. They have so much money that they, I know when I ran against Hubert Humphrey, they spent $500,000 of their own money running ads for Skip Humphrey during that campaign, $500,000. But here's the problem with waiting until, I would love to wait until government shuts down a day. I really would. I would love to call the special session July 1st, let government shut down, and that truly puts them under the gun to get their job done in a fast time because of government shutdown. But the problem with that is if I allow government to shut down, we've got a public safety problem. We would have no state troopers out on the roads. We would have certain elderly people and sick people in our state care homes would be out of funding, and you would be literally jeopardizing their public safety. And so I have to weigh those two against each other. And right now, my feeling is that that's too big of a price to pay to send out a lesson. You know, to teach a lesson, get your work done on time. But it's not fully out of the question. I mean, I haven't decided when or if I'll call it or at what time, so we will weigh all those consequences. But I just wanted Ron to know that it isn't just as simple as shutting government down, because the repercussions from a government shutdown would be disastrous, utterly disastrous. But let's remember something. When it happened to the federal government, it wasn't President Clinton that got the blame for it. It was Newt Gingrich, wasn't it, Gary?
When given what you describe as the disastrous consequences of a shutdown,
mm-hmm.
the older folks being their health endangered and no state patrol, and wouldn't it be better at this point to put the minds of those people at ease and say, well, I'm just not going to do that because of the consequences, so we'll figure out something else. Wish I could do it, but I'm not going to do that because, and just put their mind at ease?
Well, and again, though, but I can't be prepared to call it till they finish their work, Gary.
Well, assuming that their work gets done.
Well, let's not assume. Let's wait and see when their work gets done, and at that point, I'll evaluate the situation. If it gets to June 20th and they're still at an impasse, like I said to them in that meeting, I said, what is going to change? What will change between compromising now and a special session? It's the same players at the table with the same issues on the table. And so I'm sitting back right now. We're available to try to help them out any way that we can possibly, my administration, to support them. But ultimately, the legislature has to set their spending targets. They have to work out their own compromises and come to an agreement. And until they officially announce to the media that they have reached full accord and full agreement, and let me add this agreement has to meet with my standards also. I don't want them coming to an agreement that I'm going to veto. So we're a player in this game also. We're not standing on the sidelines. There are certain things, like if they're going to spend more money on K-12 education, then I want certain accountability factors put in there, like making school districts have a balanced budget. That's something I'm not going to negotiate on. That's something I'm going to demand.
Other items that are non-negotiable at this point, veto bait, if you would, profile of learning repeal, would that draw a veto?
Yes, it would.
24-hour abortion waiting period?
I've already vetoed it, so that's self-explanatory. If they want those bills, they can stand on their own. My big problem with the 24-hour waiting, and I warned them, I told them before the session, don't put it on a big omnibus bill. I sent them a letter 2 weeks prior to them doing it, reminding them again, let this bill stand on its own. Don't attach it. They, right in my face, they put it right on an omnibus bill. They did exactly what I told them not to do.
Anything else that legislators really, as far as you're concerned, ought to just forget about right now, here and now?
No, not offhand. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. There's so much that it's hard to pinpoint, you know. I need your help on that, Gary. You pick them out and I'll answer them.
Transit money, then. How about that?
Well, again, it's sad because 2 years ago in the first session, I offered them a transit package that would have funded transportation for the next 10 years. And they disregarded it. They chose not to do anything about it. Same with telecommunications reform. 2 sessions in a row, now we've offered them telecommunications reform, which they've chose to ignore. And the sad part about that is the vicious circle. You have a problem out in greater Minnesota, now rural Minnesota, of they're losing students. They don't have as many students, so subsequently they don't get as much money, and we have to subsidize them even more in schools. Well, part of the problem is because they're not up to snuff on telecommunications to where businesses will locate out there, because we're in a global economy and you have to be able to hook up to that superhighway of the internet and be able to do that. And so in order, if they would do that, that would make it more viable for business to locate out in greater Minnesota, which in turn would bring more people out there and keep their classrooms higher and they'd get more money. See how the vicious circle goes? You can't simplistically, unless you want to just subsidize, you've got to solve the bigger problem to help the even bigger problem.
Governor Jesse Ventura is our guest this hour. If you have a question for the governor, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to more of your questions in a couple of minutes.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by The Sun Newspapers, delivering community news and sports to homes in the Twin Cities, The Sun Post, The Sun Sailor, and The Sun Current. On the web at mnsun.com.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David McCullough about his new biography of John Adams, the man once described by Thomas Jefferson as the Colossus of Independence. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
That's tonight at 8 o'clock here on Minnesota Public Radio. Programming you're enjoying today is a gift in part from the members of MPR's Leadership Circle. We thank you for your support. Here's Greta Cunningham now with some news headlines. Greta?
Thanks, Gary, and good morning. Ford's CEO is on Capitol Hill briefing lawmakers on the latest safety questions involving tires on his company's vehicles. Sources say Ford will soon announce plans to replace up to 13 million Firestone tires. Bridgestone Firestone executives are defending their products. The tire company's president says the tires are absolutely safe. He says the problem is with Ford Explorers. Bridgestone Firestone announced yesterday it's ending its 95-year business relationship with Ford. Democrats continue to offer a series of amendments to President Bush's compromise tax cut plan, and that's creating a lot of frustration for Republicans. President Bush insists it's time for Congress to stop delaying and move forward, but Bush stopped short of specifically blaming Democrats, saying he views Congress as a whole. Once the measure passes the Senate, it will go to the House Senate Conference Committee. The General Accounting Office says there's still no final answer on whether cell phones are safe. Officials say the latest research fails to show there are any adverse health effects from using the phones, but it also says the findings aren't definitive. In regional news, Minnesota lawmakers passed an energy bill before they adjourned last night and sent it to Governor Ventura. The bill is designed to streamline the process for building power plants and transmission lines. The bill does not include a provision requiring utilities to use renewable power sources. Under the energy bill, the Department of Commerce is required to develop a statewide energy plan by mid-December. The plan has to specify how many power plants to build in the state and how those plants will be fueled. The forecast for Minnesota has a wind advisory for northwestern Minnesota today. It will be cloudy, blustery, and cold across the state of Minnesota with periods of showers possible. High temperatures today ranging from 48 to 58 degrees. At this hour, Duluth reports light rain and 43 degrees. It's cloudy in Rochester and 44. Cloudy in Moorhead and 47. Skies are cloudy in Sioux Falls and 52. And in the Twin Cities, still a report of some scattered light rain with a temperature of 45 degrees. Gary, that's a check on the latest news.
Thanks, Greta. 25 minutes before 12. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. Our guest this hour, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura. Lots of callers on the line with questions for the governor, so let's get back to the
Gary, let me add something first on unicameral again. Imagine if you're in the private sector and you get a contract that gives you a date of, say, to finish. You get it in January and it says finish by May 15th, right? Well, if you don't meet that deadline, you're going to go out of business. You're not going to get contracts anymore. Look at how our system is now set up. They're rewarded by not finishing on time. When they don't finish on time, they get to go into overtime, make more money through a special session. It's ridiculous the way the whole thing is set up. If you look at it from a private sector viewpoint to how government runs, government can survive because they're a monopoly and they have an unlimited supply of money and they don't have to compete. If you use those values in the private sector, you would fail and go out of business.
We're taking a survey on unicameral online, minnesotapublicradio.org. Chance to weigh in on that issue. Meanwhile, Nell's on the phone with a different question. Nell, go ahead, please.
Governor Ventura,
yes, Nell.
I find you a very practical man, and I agree with a lot of things that you say, especially about this legislature and not finishing up and spending time on impractical little things. But I think it's been pretty well documented that we have a real housing crisis in the state, especially in the Twin Cities, with 3,000 children who are homeless and about 8,000 adults. A lot of them are working. Some of them are mentally ill. You know all that.
Yes.
I just wonder why it seems to me that what's going to happen with these kids, especially, that we're going to pay more as taxpayers in a very few years for services for these kids, health, education. They'll probably be our future juvenile delinquents if we don't take care of them now. And I'm just curious why you have $24 million, I believe, in your budget, which is less than the last time. The Senate has, I think, $75 million for housing. And it's also affecting our workforce so much with this affordable housing. What's your answer to that?
Well, my answer to that is, first of all is, I can be very hardcore and say, why do people have children when they can't afford them? You know, that's a 20-year obligation that you have to accept today but again, you don't want to penalize the children who do come into the world. There's, they shouldn't be held accountable for whatever situation they come into. Last year, I gave the biggest boost to housing that they had seen in well over a decade. Kit Hadley, my commissioner of housing, can verify all of that. And again, this year it was just a case of, if people want to understand where I came from, I made two promises when I ran for governor. One was to give back all rebates, tax rebates of overtaxation, which we've done and will continue to do. The second promise I made was to limit the growth of government. And you have to remember, as government grows, you have to have two working parents. One of them has to pay just for government. If we had less government, the dollar would go a lot farther in the home. And you could get a lot more bang for your buck. But instead, you have to pay, you work now till May 8th for the government. When you start working January 1st, you go till May 8th. That's just to pay off the government. And then the rest is your money. Now, getting back to the housing, I agree there's a housing problem. But getting back to where I was in this year's budget, permanent government growth under my first 2 years was almost 13%. I am not going to allow permanent government growth to go to 25% on my watch. That is unacceptable to me, and that is why I gave the parameters to my commissioners to keep it down. We came in with a budget with only 5.4% growth, which you add that to the 13, you end up with 18-some percent over my 4 years. Government should not grow faster than people's personal income. Government should grow barely. It should be on line with inflation much more. And so the caller, Nell, has to understand the more money that we spend, the more then you have to pay government out of your own personal checks and your own personal incomes. And it's a vicious circle that goes on. When government grows so large, it's like a big engine that has to be fueled with gasoline. The bigger the engine gets, the more gas it takes, and the gas is tax dollars and money.
This sounds like a goofy question, probably is, but given the tax rates in Minnesota, given the what appear to be a long list of legitimate needs for government spending increases of one sort or another, you suppose it's possible that we are both overtaxed and underfunded in many respects? You know what I'm saying here?
I kind of, there's a lot of need out there. I think that it's part of the fault of government is government gets into places where it doesn't really belong. And that's called self-sufficiency, you taking care of yourself. Gary, government, the simple definition for government is this. Government should only do for you what you're incapable of doing for yourself. And our problem is we have far too many programs out there that go beyond that definition. That government starts to be parents, government starts to be this, government's that to everyone. And when we start to become so reliant upon government, believe me, ladies and gentlemen, that reliance comes with a price tag. And the more reliant you are on government, the more taxes you will pay. And the bad thing is that government doesn't usually give you a very good bang for the buck. For every dollar you send to government, there's so much bureaucracy involved. How much return do you get on that money? That's why I always tell people, you know, why is the federal government even involved in education other than special ed funding that? Because for every dollar we send to this federal government, you're lucky to get 30 cents back on it. You're lucky to get that. That's not efficient. That would be unacceptable in the private sector.
Andrea, your question, please.
Hi, Governor. I heard a quote that said you were embarrassed by the legislature not being able to finish their job.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering how you can even use that when you embarrass the state.
How did I embarrass the state?
I don't know. Pretty much every time you open your mouth,
really?
You don't sound real bright, and it's really embarrassing
for
the way people look at Minnesota.
Really? Well, I feel bad, Andrea. What party do you belong to?
I'm independent.
Oh, sure. Good answer. Well, you know, I got elected, and I got elected for who I am, Andrea, so you'd prefer me to change who I am?
Oops, let's get her back on the line.
To make us look good.
So you'd prefer me to be something I'm not?
Well, I'd prefer
you want an actor, then. You want a typical politician.
Well, I'd like
who
to
says
someone who at least has grammar skills.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, then don't vote for me.
I didn't.
Well, there you go.
Okay.
So it shows you have an agenda. So, you know, I accept your criticism, but the point being is grammar skills aren't required for common sense.
Herb, your question, please.
Yeah, Governor, I want to
thank you
for taking the phone calls today. Also, I want to thank you for all the work you've done, although I may not have always agreed with your policies.
Sure.
I have a great deal of respect for all the time it takes and everything you're doing. And unlike the previous caller, I respect the office of governor and think that you need to continue to do the work you need to do as you were elected for. Here's my question. You stated earlier that you thought that the legislature had abandoned your telecom project or your telecom policies, and that leads to problems in outstate Minnesota. I live on the North Shore of Minnesota, and we have a very, very strong internet infrastructure. We have very high-speed internet access to the area.
Mm-hmm.
I also work for one of the major corporations in Minnesota as citing businesses in their business development area. And I will tell you that I think you've got the vicious cycle wrong, that when businesses look in an area, the first thing they do, obviously, look at is they look at things like tax structures and costs and that type of thing. They also look for skilled workers.
Yep.
And the third thing they look for is they look for the education system. And our school systems on the North Shore, like the ones in other parts of outstate Minnesota, are suffering because of the loss in population. My question to you is...
Let me ask you a question. Why are you losing population?
I think we're losing population because of demographics, because you're right, businesses aren't there.
Why aren't they there?
I think they're not there because the population moves out. We don't have the skilled workers. There's nothing to keep people there. The cost to transfer goods, the cost of government, the cost of taxes. Those are the type of things that, you know, keep businesses from actually setting up an area. The smaller businesses like the tourist industry, things like that have taken off and have done great guns, but they aren't the type of businesses that keep people in town and keep the kids when they graduate high school to be there to be in place.
Well, first let me tell you something, Herb. Nothing's going to keep the kids that graduate from high school there.
You don't think if they had a reasonable job and a decent paying job or something?
No, Herb, think back to when you graduated. I can think back to when I graduated, Herb. I joined the Navy. Why? Because I wanted to see the world. I was 18 to 24 years of age. I had read and saw things about the world, but I had never experienced it. People who believe young people aren't going to go out and explore the world are fooling themselves. Young people are going to move away. I came back home many years later. I lived in Portland, Oregon. I lived in Honolulu. I lived in Hamden, Connecticut. I lived in Kansas City. I lived all over the country. But the point being, if you think kids are going to graduate from high school and are going to just sit in their hometown where they graduated, I think you're mistaken, because most kids at that age have a great exploratory mind. They want to go out and experience life, and they want to go out beyond the borders of Minnesota.
Anyway,
Herb, your question then. The question was, don't you think that having a good, strong educational system is important to attracting quality jobs and quality businesses to those areas.
Yes, I do.
And by having a disparate funding system from the metro area versus the outstate area currently, with all the fixed costs that exist, not just the variable costs that we pay per student, don't you think that puts outstate Minnesota at a disadvantage to attracting businesses?
Yes, okay. It probably does. Sir. I agree with you. Yes, it does.
In general, how much, you were mentioning earlier that on the assumption that the legislature would end up appropriating more money for K-12 education than you proposed, you wanted some accountability factors built in.
Yes.
Is there any limit as to how much you would accept in the way of additional spending for K-12 education?
Well,
because even the Senate bill, you know, the education folks are saying even the Senate bill, which is substantially larger than isn't going to be enough.
Well, you got to remember, there'll never be enough for them. I mean, the last budget, I gave them $1 billion. And now that wasn't enough either. And that billion reoccurs. That wasn't one-time money. That's continuous money. That same billion from the last budget continues on and on and on and on. So I think it's very difficult when you deal with something that can't tell you how much money that they need. And it concerns me a lot when you look at the situation out there and you see private schools flourishing with budgets far less than what our public schools have. And, there's waiting lists to get into the private schools. We need to do something with our whole system, because we are also now number one in homeschool. Now, that's telling us something, that our public schools need to buckle up a little bit more. And I don't simply believe, as many people try to say, I don't believe that simply putting money, and it's been proven statistically, putting money into a school system is not the only answer. That doesn't solve the problems, just throwing money at it. And I want some accountability. I think we should change how we pay teachers. I think that we should have certain teachers in the sciences and the math and that, where there's shortages, that we should look at building those particular basic core teaching up. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the other teaching, not that that's not important too, but your core issues, just like in government, are the most important ones.
University President Udoff said on the mid-morning program here last hour that, barring some dramatic change, and he wasn't taking a shot at you or the legislature, he just said, barring some dramatic change in the way we think about higher education in Minnesota, in the next 3, 4, 5 years, tuition at the U will basically double. From about 4,500 to, well, it won't double, it'll go up about 40%, to about 7,500 or so. Is that reasonable in your mind, given our tradition here of kind of open access to the U?
Yeah, well, it's tough, because the U has to understand they're a research university and they can't be everything to everyone, I don't believe, in light of our Minscu system. We're getting a lot of overlapping that goes on between the two systems, and I think when you're in a situation where budgets are so important and money is so important, that we shouldn't have that overlapping going on in the higher ed system. And you look at it and you say to yourself, also, I think higher education has gotten to the point where we have some philosophy today that it's for everyone. I remember, Gary, that when I graduated from high school, college wasn't for everyone. And I think you're seeing that today. Something's wrong when that latest information came out that 30% of the kids going to college today are having to take remedial courses that they should have passed and had in high school. Now, something's wrong there. Get my picture? Mm-hmm. Why should they be taking repeat courses that they should have already had in high school, and why should college be providing that for them? If they can't compete and don't belong there, then they shouldn't be in college unless they can meet the standards to be there. Or is it just simply a business where anyone can go if you've got the money or the means to be there?
Gary, quick question before we wrap up.
Yes, Governor. You're doing a great job.
Thanks, Gary. I appreciate that.
And I'd like to ask your opinion. Do you think that one of the things that has to happen is for the citizens to get a lot more involved in paying attention to what their elected representatives are doing?
Gary, I couldn't echo that more than what you've just said, because it's the old case over there, Gary. The squeaky wheel gets the oil. And nothing shows that more than government. If there's no squeaking, you will get ignored. You notice who's top priority? Education Minnesota. Why? Because they have the lobbying power. They have the money. They get over there. They have the lobbyists. And in order to go back to unicameral again, unless the public cries out and says this system of ours doesn't function the way it should be, then you will continue with this bicameral system, and you will continue with these special sessions. You'll continue with things being put off. How could it be good government? It's like when you got an assignment in school. Gary, for a minute. Both Garys, if you're both Garys, Gary Eichten and Gary the caller. Remember when you were in grade school and at the beginning of a semester, say in January, they tell you, okay, you've got to do this big project and it's got to be done by May 15th or you're not going to move up a grade, right? Remember those? Now, if you're a smart, bright kid who gets on top of things, you start working on it right away and you get it done by, say, the middle of April. Then you're home free. But what does this system now do? The system now that we have in government is like the kid who goes out and plays baseball, goes out and doesn't pay attention, and procrastinates till finally you get to the point where you've got 10 days to go before you're due to get kicked up and that project's due, and you spend your whole last weekend just jamming 24 hours a day in an attempt to get it done so you can move up a grade higher. Now, which project tends to produce the better work? The project that was done with good, timely manner, where it was done over a period of time with a lot of aforethought put into it, or the project that's jammed in at the very end and it's a rush to judgment in the final 48 or 72 hours? You know the answer, don't you, Gary? Absolutely. Well, our government, that's the way it's set up today, is the rush to judgment, final 72-hour situation where everything is crammed in, and the legislators are voting on bills that they haven't even read or are just told how to vote on them by their caucuses because they have no input into them in the final hours. It's cutting the deals in the last 48 hours is how it works.
In this sense, then, I would think the special session, the fact we're going to have a special session, a little better than just passing bills willy-nilly at the last second.
Not really, because they'll still be willy-nilly to get done with the special session. You know, the problem is that they spent 2 months there worrying about whether kids under 18 get tattoos, worried about what Governor Ventura does on his Saturday nights, worried about pop in school, worried about hot dishes, and things of that nature. Let's do the critical business first. Let's change this system so it requires us to do critical things first. And as I said, leave the fluff stuff for the end of the session where if nothing happens on it, it won't be a live or die situation.
Governor, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Gary. Always a pleasure.
Our guest this hour, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura. Just a reminder, coming up over the noon hour, conversations with House Speaker Steve Swigum and Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe.
And Gary, I apologize for my grammar.
Congress is on the verge of passing the biggest tax cut in 20 years, but critics say the bill treats most Americans unfairly.
The tax cut is heavily tilted towards upper-income people in ways that are not necessary.
I'm Juan Williams. Will you get a piece of the Bush tax cut? That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation is on at 1 o'clock each afternoon here on Minnesota Public Radio. By the way, the governor's comment in the background, he apologized for his grammar. Time now for the Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 22nd of May, 2001. It was on this day in 1967, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood had its premiere on television, starring Fred Rogers, a Presbyterian minister. It's the birthday of Gary Wills, born in Atlanta, 1934, author of over two dozen books dealing with subjects as diverse as race relations and the Catholic Church. His most recent book, Papal Sin, Structures of Deceit. Among his best-known books is Nixon Agonistes, in which he made a case that Richard Nixon was, in fact, a liberal. It's the birthday of children's author and illustrator Arnold Lobel, born in Los Angeles, 1933. Died young, age of 54, of a heart attack, but wrote or illustrated 100 books, including the children's classic Frog and Toad Are Friends, in 1970. It's the birthday of Peter Matheson, born in New York City, 1927, author of many books, novels, including At Play in the Fields of the Lord, and a trilogy of novels placed in the Florida Everglades, The Snow Leopard, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, and Shadows of Africa. It's the birthday of actor and director Sir Laurence Olivier, born in Surrey in 1907. His father was a strict Anglican clergyman, but when he saw that the boy had talent, he made him stay in England and study to become an actor. Olivier made his debut playing Brutus in a production of Caesar at a choir school in London. The actress Sybil Thorndike was in the audience. She recalled, "Olivier had been on stage for only 5 minutes when I turned to my husband and said, 'This is an actor.'" It's the birthday of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, born at Picardy Place in Edinburgh, Scotland, 1859. Best known for his celebrated series of books about the hawk-eyed amateur detective Sherlock Holmes and his friend and foil, Dr. Watson. Though the famous phrase, "Elementary, my dear Watson," does not, in fact, appear in any of the Sherlock Holmes books. The first Sherlock Holmes title was A Study in Scarlet in 1887. And it was in 1703 on this date, writer Daniel Defoe was fined and imprisoned for 6 months at Newgate Prison and later put in the public pillory for having written a satiric pamphlet, The Shortest Way with Dissenters, the year before. Defoe was himself a dissenter from the Church of England, and the pamphlet ironically demanded the savage suppression of all dissent. Here's a poem for today by Raymond Carver, Happiness. So early it's still almost dark out. I'm near the window with coffee and the usual early morning stuff that passes for thought. When I see the boy and his friend walking up the road to deliver the newspaper. They wear caps and sweaters, and one boy has a bag over his shoulder. They're so happy. They aren't saying anything, these boys. I think if they could, they would take each other's arm. It's early in the morning, and they're doing this thing together. They come on slowly. The sky is taking on light, though the moon still hangs pale over the water. Such beauty that for a minute death and ambition, even love, doesn't enter into this. Happiness, it comes on unexpectedly and goes beyond really any early morning talk about it. A poem by Raymond Carver, Happiness, from All of Us, the Collected Poems, published by Alfred A. Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, brought to you by the people at 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find 13 million gently read classics, bestsellers, and rare masterpieces on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Technical